From World Radio and the team that brings you the world and everything in it, this is the Legal Docket Podcast.
The EEOC accused my business of discrimination because of sex.
That's Tom Rost from a prepared statement.
A term the agency wanted to change to include gender identity. But sex and gender identity are very different things.
He doesn't talk to the media, and he agreed only to read straight off that statement. Ross is a businessman in Michigan who owns and operates a funeral home. The government sued him for sex discrimination, even though he followed the letter of the law.
Our job as judges, of course, is to interpret the words consistent with their ordinary meaning at the time that Congress enacted the statute.
That's Justice Neil Gorsuch announcing the opinion in a 2018 railroad case. Back to Tom Rost. He recalls the purpose of the three branches of government.
And only Congress, not courts or federal agencies, can change the law.
Again, Justice Gorsuch, this time with the opinion in a trucking case.
After all, if judges could freely infuse old statutory terms with entirely new and different meanings, we would risk amending statutes outside the legislative process the Constitution commands.
Businesses must be able to rely on what the law is at the time they make business decisions.
It would seem that these two men vigorously agree.
We would risk to upsetting reliance interests by subjecting people today to different rules than they enjoyed when the statute was passed.
Different businesses, a funeral home, a railroad, a trucking firm.
Employers shouldn't be held liable simply for following what the law says.
A justice, a businessman. Different facts, different statutes. Yet underlying principles in the law endure. These principles direct judges to interpret and apply the law fairly and consistently. In the case of Tom Rost, the man he'd hired as his funeral director wanted to become a woman. No law told Rost what to do or not to do in that situation. So in August 2013, he made a decision based on his knowledge and experience, things he'd always relied upon to help grieving families, provide jobs for others, and earn a decent living. Little did he know that the justice who spoke eloquently about legal principles would write the opinion to defeat him.
I, Clarence Thomas.
I, Sonia Sotomayor.
I, Stephen Breyer.
I, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice
without respect to persons.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge
the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
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 Welcome to Legal Docket. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Jenny Ruff. This podcast is from the team that brings you the world and everything in it.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Come with us inside the world of the Supreme Court as we look more deeply into current disputes and how they make a difference to your life.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States.
We've chosen a handful of cases from this past term that we think you will find thought-provoking and worthy of deeper consideration. Today, a case about sex discrimination.
God save the United States and this honorable court.
Support for the Legal Docket Podcast comes from listeners like you. World is grateful for your generosity, which makes possible the journalism that powers this program. WNG.org/donate.
The case against Tom Rost involved an employee with gender dysphoria. Argued on the same day were two other cases based on sexual orientation. Those two were consolidated into one case, best known as Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia. Tom Rost's case is called Harris Funeral Homes, Inc. versus EEOC. All three disputes arise from the same allegation, that the employers violated Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Our story focuses on Tom Rost's case, the funeral home operator.
Our business exists to serve grieving families. There is no time in life more difficult than after losing a loved one.
110 years ago, his grandfather started the funeral home business Rost operates today. That's the norm in the United States. Almost 90% of funeral homes are owned and operated by individuals or families, closely held private corporations. Over the years, Rost's grandfather and father, and now he, hired many people.
In a funeral home, the most public-facing employee is the funeral director. This person is usually one of the first that families encounter after a loved one dies. The demeanor of the funeral director is a crucial aspect of that job. Calm, serious, compassionate. So when the job of funeral director opened up in 2007, Rost hired Anthony Stevens. That after reviewing the job requirements, including the way he'd dress.
Our company has a professional code of conduct and sex-specific dress code to ensure that families can focus on processing their grief. In 2007, we hired a male funeral director who agreed to follow those policies.
The dress code followed the same rules as for federal agencies. Here's Stevens in an interview with Michael Barbaro on The Daily, aired in November 2019. By this time, Anthony Stevens had a new first name.
My name is Amy Stevens. I'm 58 years old, and I live in Redford, Michigan. Ever since I was a little kid, I've been fascinated with the funeral industry. I was hired in as a funeral director and embalmer. It was a chance to be able to comfort people in their probably one of the worst times of their lives. And for me, it was a calling.
Stevens and Rost are alike in that each felt called to help grieving people get through tough times. But that alignment derailed when Stevens made a request. Rost explains.
Nearly 6 years later, the employee gave me a letter expressing an intent to violate the dress code by dressing and presenting as a woman when working with grieving families.
Listen to Stevens read part of that letter to Rost. This is from the same interview with The Daily.
I have a gender identity disorder that I have struggled with my entire life.
For Rost, this was a startling change.
I felt deep concern for the employee. I care about all the people who work for me.
For Stevens, this was a long time coming.
I have managed to hide it very well all these years. I have been in therapy for nearly 4 years now, and I have been diagnosed as a transsexual.
Stevens' revelation and subsequent requests were not something Rost thought was good for his business or his grieving clients or his other employees.
I spent a couple of weeks thinking over what the employee's proposal meant for everyone involved, including my other employees and our clients.
It's worth noting that there were ups and downs in Stevens' tenure before this. In early 2013, a manager wanted to end Stevens' employment, but Tom Rost, the funeral home owner, intervened to save Stevens' job. But a few months later, Rost did end up firing Stevens. He offered severance pay. Stevens refused to accept it, then took a complaint of sex discrimination to the ACLU for advice. Lawyers there referred the matter to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the government agency that enforces civil rights laws against workplace discrimination.
At that point, I knew I had to do something. And the only thing I knew to do was basically to take it to court.
The EEOC, on behalf of Stevens, sued the funeral home for violating Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That says employers cannot discriminate based on religion, race, national origin, or sex. That's the important word to remember. Now, both parties in the lawsuit concede that back in the 60s, when the law passed, sex was understood as a scientific concept. Male, female, XX, or XY chromosomes.
But to Stevens' way of thinking, Rost handed over a pink slip based on sex in violation of that law. Because when he wanted to become a she and lost the job, that seemed like discrimination based on sex. Well, let's step back in time and find out what was going on in the United States when Title VII became law. The 1960s saw civil rights as front and center. Martin Luther King Jr. led the fight for racial equality under the law.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
The women's movement was also on the rise. Feminist Betty Friedan rose to fame with her book The Feminine Mystique. She talked about stereotypes of men and women that don't serve society well.
Those boys who are wearing their hair long are saying no to that brutal, sadistic, tight-lipped, crew-cut, big muscle, you know, Ernest Hemingway, to prove that I'm a man and never show any softness.
Against that backdrop, a trilogy of laws, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Equal Pay Act, and the Age Discrimination in Employment Law. The idea behind each? Consider what the individual can do. Don't cast him or her into a group. Don't layer on stereotypes.
Around this time, a young lawyer named Ruth Bader Ginsburg worked for the ACLU. She was using the law to upend society's expectations for women. Ginsburg looked for cases to show the all-male Supreme Court justices the trouble with treating men and women so differently under the law.
She found such a case and took it before the Supreme Court in 1975. Ginsburg argued against a part of the Social Security Act that denied widowed fathers benefits given to widowed mothers. Note that this has been edited for Flo from the original audio.
But there could not be a clearer case than this one of the double-edged sword in operation, of differential treatment accorded similarly situated persons based grossly and solely on gender. In practical effect, laws of this quality help to keep women not on a pedestal, but in a cage.
Ginsburg pointed out that the law should be neutral in this area of private family decisions. Yet here was a federal law giving a family benefit based on the husband's job and barred the same benefit based on the wife's job.
The impact is to encourage the traditional division of labor between man and woman.
Ginsburg won that case 8-0. The justices adopted both her arguments and her language, saying the gender of the parent had nothing to do with the purpose of the law. The High Court agreed. The purpose of the law was to provide Social Security benefits to care for children when one or the other parent dies.
On that basis, the court ruled that part of the law violated the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. So all these things came together in the 60s and 70s under the banner of civil rights.
Now, fast forward to the 1990s. Some people desired to extend civil rights to include sexual orientation. In 1994, Congress considered a bill that would have prohibited employment discrimination based on sexual orientation while exempting religious organizations. It was known as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. Lawmakers filed similar bills for the next 20 years, but ENDA never made it to a president's desk.
In the absence of legislation, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission stepped in. In 2012, it changed the way it interpreted the word sex. The agency said the word would now not only mean male and female, it would also mean sexual orientation and gender identity. People in those groups would receive the same protections in employment.
2 years later, President Barack Obama issued an executive order. It prohibited discrimination in the civilian federal workforce on the basis of gender identity. Also in hiring by federal contractors on the basis of both sexual orientation and gender identity. In so doing, it redefined the word sex to mean something other than male or female.
Of course, a fundamental change like that is a recipe for trouble in very pragmatic ways.
It literally creates a communication challenge for a lot of our companies that have got very, very diverse workforces.
That's Mike Sharrow, CEO of C12 Group, an international organization that helps people of faith grow their businesses. When basic meanings are suddenly altered, business operations can get messy quickly. He gives this real-life example from the medical field.
So I work with some companies that deal with medical data, where one of the most important things about assessing your medical status is your gender. Well, if intake forms and lab data pieces lose their pronoun fidelity, it literally creates a question for doctors, nurses, and healthcare data analytic companies. I mean, well, how do I know that I'm making the right judgment on data? Like, I could make a malpractice decision unintentionally.
And it doesn't stop there either.
And then as a company, you go to underwrite your health insurance. Your underwriting tables look at number of people, age of people, and genders. Do I report to the health insurance company my employee workforce based upon their gender identity, or their biological gender? And do I need to now bifurcate those in my systems? Because I could literally violate my underwriting contract with health insurance, claiming a certain gender ratio that's not true.
For Tom Rost's funeral home business, he considered his female employees and clients who would be sharing a single-sex restroom with Stevens. He thought about his grieving clients and how they'd feel. He considered how his decision might affect Stevens' wife. Meanwhile, Stevens' lawsuit continued. Eventual victory for Stevens in the U.S. Court of Appeals meant Tom Rost had to appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court.
We'll hear argument next in case 18107, R.G. and G.R. Harris, Funeral Homes versus the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
October 8th, 2019. The lawyers had to convince the justices that that one word, sex, under Title VII, either means only male and female or does not mean only male and female. Lawyer David Cole represented Stevens.
The purpose of Title VII was to make sex irrelevant to people's ability to succeed at work. When Harris Holmes fired Amy Stevens because it learned about her sex assigned at birth being different from her gender identity, it did not make sex irrelevant to her ability to succeed at work. It made it determinative. And think about it this way. If Harris Holmes fired a man because he was a man, that would be sex discrimination. If it fired an employee because he was insufficiently masculine, that would clearly be sex discrimination. In this case, Harris Holmes fired Amy Stevens because he thought she is a man who is insufficiently masculine. That, too, must be sex discrimination.
Tom Ross lawyer John Birch pointed out that Title VII says nothing about sexual orientation or gender identity. Birch said that in 1964, sex did not mean transgender in any context, including employment.
And yet, Justice Elena Kagan was not buying it. The same day, the court heard argument in another sex discrimination case involving a gay man, the Bostock case. Listen to this exchange between Justice Kagan and Solicitor General Noel Francisco from that oral argument.
You talked about the history of Title VII and some of the subsequent legislative history. And I guess what strikes me, and I was struck in reading your briefs, too, is that the arguments you're making are not ones we typically would accept. For many years, the lodestar of this court's statutory interpretation has been the text of a statute, not the legislative history, and certainly not the subsequent legislative history. Did you discriminate against somebody, against her client because of sex? Yes, you did, because you fired the person because this was a man who loved other men. And part of that is you fired the person because he was a man. If he were a woman, he wouldn't have been fired. This is the usual kind of way in which we interpret statutes now.
Justice Kagan asked Francisco, why doesn't your argument fail? Because we don't look to desires, we look to laws.
Because, Your Honor, I think that what our brief attempts to do, at least, is make a straightforward textual argument. The law distinguishes between sex and sexual orientation. Those are two different traits. And that's precisely why when Congress wants to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, it doesn't define sex as including sexual orientation. It lists it as a different trait.
Francisco is arguing sexual orientation and biological sex are different traits. Tom Ross' lawyer used that same argument with transgender and biological sex.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
John Birch.
Treating women and men equally does not mean employers have to treat men as women. That is because sex and transgender status are independent concepts.
Birch brought in the problem of agencies legislating.
The problem here is that under their theory, the federal agency that brought this claim and then an unelected panel in the Sixth Circuit changed the law. They added a transgender classification, applied it to a business retroactively. And what's more, the Sixth Circuit said that sex itself is a stereotype.
Birch made 3 points in rapid succession. First, sex is not the same as transgender. Second, an agency should not change the meaning of a word. And third, a lower court essentially decided that biological sex is a stereotype. Now, Justice Gorsuch listened intently to these arguments. He'd recently published a book titled A Republic If You Can Keep It. In it, he describes how he interprets the law. It's a concept called originalism. In September 2019, the U.S. National Archives invited Gorsuch to talk about his book. Note that we've edited for time.
Maybe we ought to start with what the heck is originalism. All it is, though, is the idea that judges should interpret written laws according to their original public meaning. And it says judges should not be in the business of making things up, adding to or taking away from the Constitution. What happens when we depart from the original public meaning? The alternative is something people like to call a living Constitution. All right? Now, that actually sounds pretty good. Who wants a dead Constitution? How about an enduring Constitution? I like that. A lasting Constitution. Living. Who does the living? The judges do the living. And here's what happens when judges do the living. They evolve your rights, and some go away, and some new ones appear. And as an originalist, it's all about preserving the Constitution that you have written.
This was a month prior to argument in the Harris Funeral Homes case. So back to that oral argument. Lawyer Bursch, again for Tom Rost, pointed out that business owners have some leeway in how to run their businesses under Title VII.
Now, in the context of this case, Title VII gives Tom Rost the ability to consider how enforcement of a sex-specific dress code would impact all his employees and grieving clients.
And then Bursch argued that if the court redefines sex to mean transgender, bad consequences will logically follow.
My friends, but for test would mean that a woman's overnight shelter must hire a man who identifies as a woman to serve as a counselor to women who have been raped, trafficked, and abused, and also share restroom, shower, and locker room facilities with them. That is because, but for the man's sex, he would be allowed to hold that job and to use those facilities.
The jousting continued. Bursch went on to argue that this isn't for the Supreme Court to decide. Yet, lawyer Cole, arguing for Stevens, said it's very much in the Supreme Court's purview to interpret statutes. After all, he argued, Congress can change what it doesn't like.
Echoes of the separation of powers in that, a theme of Justice Gorsuch's book. I want to jump back now to that interesting discussion. You can hear him emphasize that theme in another excerpt from his talk at the National Archives.
So what am I? I am 1/9 of 1/3 of our federal government, which is 1/2 of the governments in our federal system. Divide power. That was the wisdom of Madison. Now, that all sounds pretty academic and maybe a little wonkish, but as a judge, I came to realize and see in the real world the impact muddling up the separation of powers has on your liberty.
Two concepts at play there in that speech, originalism and separation of powers. At oral argument, Justice Gorsuch may have been weighing those two things.
When a case is really close on the textual evidence, and I assume for the moment I'm with you on the textual evidence, is close, okay? At the end of the day, should he or she take into consideration the massive social upheaval that would be entailed in such a decision and the possibility that Congress didn't think about it?
So,
and that is a more appropriate legislative rather than a judicial function. That's it. It's a question of judicial modesty.
The decision came down 6-3. Gorsuch delivered the opinion, joined by Roberts, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. The majority held that sex under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 includes LGBT people in the workplace.
Instead of applying the ordinary meaning of the word sex as understood at that time, the majority applied the literal meaning of the word today. Now, we'll delve into that in a moment.
Different meaning, different outcome. Ask a different question, get a different answer.
Now, you've no doubt already picked up on the inconsistency. And here's another curiosity. Justice Gorsuch wrote the opinion, and in it, he acknowledges that in 1964, hardly anyone thought sex referred to anything other than biological male and female. And yet, this case is about employment. Getting fired for traits or actions that wouldn't be questioned in the opposite sex? Therefore, sex played a role in the decision to fire. And that, he wrote, is what Title VII forbids. I contacted the ACLU to comment for this story and received no response from them. John Bursch did speak with me after the ruling came down. I wanted his help to understand the opinion.
I think that was a surprise to many people, and I don't think there's any question that the original public meaning of discrimination because of sex did not include sexual orientation or gender identity. But Justice Gorsuch's opinion took this literalist approach, used some dictionaries, and concluded that it must.
Mary, the terms originalist and textualist are often used interchangeably. Lots of overlap and nuance there. And for ease, we do that today. On a future episode, we'll have to dive into the differences. For now, the question begging to be asked, if Gorsuch is an originalist, what happened to that approach to interpreting the law?
Well, here's a quote from the opinion that might help us understand, five sentences or so. Those who adopted the Civil Rights Act might not have anticipated their work would lead to this particular result. Likely, they weren't thinking about many of the Act's consequences that have become apparent over the years. But the limits of the drafter's imagination supply no reason to ignore the law's demands. When the express terms of a statute give us one answer and extra textual considerations suggest another, it's no contest. Only the written word is the law, and all persons are entitled to its benefit.
A textualist like Justice Scalia and like Justice Gorsuch would start with the dictionary and define the terms of the statute and then try to put those together and discern what an ordinary American with a reasonable command of English would have understood at the time that the statute was enacted. So here we look at discrimination, and that means treating somebody differently because of some inherent trait, but doing so in a negative way. Then because of sex, he correctly defined sex as it was understood in 1964. And today, as being something biologically based, objective, cannot be changed, and is based on reproductive functions.
So what was Justice Gorsuch thinking? John Bursch took a guess.
He inserted gender identity theology, if you want to call it that, into those words. He said that the employee was not a male. It was someone who was assigned a male sex at birth, and that today they identify as female. But you can see he's introduced a theology of gender identity that no one in 1964 would have understood. In
fact, the purpose of the original statute was to prevent women from being treated worse than men in employment because they are women, or vice versa. That is how the U.S. Supreme Court had interpreted it to mean for half a century, until now. Again, John Bursch.
And that's a very untextualist, un-Scalia-like approach. The plaintiff was a biological male employee who wanted to present and dress as a woman. And we would call that person in 1964 a male. And then the question is, if you're going to require a male to follow the sex-specific dress code, would you have also required a female to follow the sex-specific dress code? The answer to that would be yes. So because a man was not being treated worse than a woman, there is no discrimination because of sex.
An article published in the National Review this summer points out that Justice Gorsuch's analysis did not begin with first principles. Law professors Randy Barnett and Josh Blackman say the court's opinion could be called halfway textualism, arguing that it was built on a shaky foundation that ignored contrary evidence to serve a desired outcome. They say ordinary meaning here was traded out in favor of a specialized, technical legal meaning. One way to tease out the problem with that is explained by lawyer Randall Wenger. He filed an amicus brief in this case on behalf of Dr. Paul McHugh, a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Wenger takes up a troublesome aspect of this ruling.
So the court explicitly didn't apply it to situations like locker rooms and showers and women's sports. But the logic of the decision is such, it really changes the analysis.
In fact, the ruling's already been used to allow a biological female to use the male facilities in a school district in Florida. In August 2020, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals cited the Harris opinion as its authority on the matter.
I think what's frustrating is looking at the way that categories of sex have really been hijacked. So in a very Orwellian way, you take language and then change its meaning and pretend that you really haven't changed anything at all is kind of an unfair way of trying to change culture. There is such a thing as sex that's based on biological differences, and we shouldn't be afraid to acknowledge that truth. And that's one thing that I'm grateful before Gorsuch's opinion, he did not conflate gender identity with sex. But unfortunately, the decision has implications that put others in trouble.
Implications that create instability in other realms of life.
Well, Mary, let's return to the opinion itself and look at the dissents from Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Brett Kavanaugh.
Okay, and here's where we slow down to understand the difference between the ordinary and literal meaning of words. Justice Kavanaugh gave an example of the difference. He wrote, "A statutory ban on vehicles in the park would literally encompass a baby stroller. But no good judge would interpret the statute that way because the word vehicle, in its ordinary meaning, does not encompass baby strollers."
And Justice Alito's dissent laid out the evidence that consensus was never reached that the word sex means anything other than male and female. Here's Bursch again to explain.
Congress has tried to amend Title VII more than 50 times to add the concept of sexual orientation and a dozen times to add the concept of gender identity and has failed every time.
And the danger in changing that going forward?
Advocates will now try to use this opinion to weaponize those statutes to attack those who don't hold beliefs about marriage and gender identity similar to the plaintiffs in these cases, to try to prevent them from being able to live out their beliefs, their faith in the public square and in their businesses.
I asked Lawyer Bursch if he thinks the court has set us on course to have to fight for religious freedom for the rest of our lives.
I don't know about the rest of our lives, but it could be close to that long. The opinion specifically says it's not resolving sex-specific dress codes. It says it doesn't deal with sex-specific policies involving privacy spaces. That would be showers, restrooms, locker rooms, overnight accommodations. It doesn't purport to deal with the athletic situation.
Now, the Supreme Court takes a case based on a particular legal question. Here, the question was whether sex in Title VII included gender identity. So the majority answered that as yes. In other words, this decision resolved one narrow question. The court didn't take on other questions, like how religious liberty plays in. And Mary, you know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
World correspondent Steve West once said it perfectly. That question is left for another day. Or, more likely, many other days before many other courts. So many questions left unanswered. Again, Ross lawyer John Bursch.
The court says it is specifically not addressing anything about religious liberty defenses. Title VII has an exemption for religious organizations. There's also a ministerial exception for religious organizations. There are also free exercise rights for non-religious organizations that want to operate their businesses according to religious principles. And all of those are still on the table.
So, what happened to Tom Rost? The Harris family business has endured a lot. And then this litigation ensued, losing with the EEOC, winning at the district court, losing at the appeals court, and now a loss at the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's more from his recorded statement.
In the past century, our family's business has survived two world wars, the Great Depression, and a decades-long economic downturn in the city we call home.
Rost maintains this case ended up at the Supreme Court so that the courts could continue their unconstitutional use of power.
Sadly, we were just a means to their end of redefining the law without Congress. The livelihood and legacy of not only my family business, but other family businesses across the country were left hanging in the balance before the Supreme Court. Because what the court decides impacts people across the country.
And what became of the fired employee in this case? Well, Stevens never heard how the justices decided. Stevens died on May 12th from kidney failure. Tom Rost sent condolences to the family. Legal Docket is produced by the creative team at World Radio. I'm Jenny Ruff.
And I'm Mary Reichard. We're the hosts each week.
Our script editors are Nick Eicher and J.C. Derrick. Technical engineer is Rich Rosel. And our producer is Paul Butler.
We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is legaldocket@wng.org. Send us your comments or questions, and we'll see if we can address those in future episodes or in upcoming segments on The World and Everything in It. Again, our email address is legaldocket@wng.org.
And while you're at it, can you take a moment and leave a comment about the program wherever you listen to this podcast? Comments and reviews are a great way to get the word out. Thanks for listening.
For the next 4 weeks, you'll be hearing the Legal Docket podcast on The World and Everything in It each Saturday. Episode 7 releases September 12th. We also release Legal Docket as a standalone series on its own feed, and we're publishing new episodes there each Tuesday. So if you'd like to listen sooner or help others find this new series, subscribe by searching for Legal Docket on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.